Are you troubled by strange hockey trades in the middle of the night?
Do you experience feelings of dread about NHL free agency?
Have you or your family ever seen a New York Islanders game?
If the answer is yes, then don't wait another minute. Pick up your mobile device and subscribe to Lighthouse Hockey Podcast from SB Nation today.
Our courteous and efficient hosts are ready to serve all of your Islander needs and worries.
Lighthouse Hockey Podcasts for New York Islanders fans.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to From Complex to Queens, Amazing Avenue's Minor League Podcast. I am Steve Saipa, and I'm joined by Lucas Vlahos and Ken Lavin. How you guys doing?
Good.
Pretty good.
All right, so we'll start with Promote Extend Trade, and this one is going to be going back a few years. On this date in 480 AD, Otto Acer, he assumed power in the Western Roman Empire. He was a Germanic barbarian mercenary. He worked his way up the Roman army ranks. And then when the German mercenaries in Italy started to rebel, he led them, and he eventually seized control of Italy. And obviously, him deposing Romulus Augustus, who was the last traditional Roman emperor, had a pretty profound impact on history and was one of the major reasons why the Roman Empire in the West fell. So, in honor of those Germanic mercenaries, who are we going to promote, extend, or trade of these German minor leaguers? First, there's Kai Gronauer, and he was born in Solingen, Germany, and he's actually, like, fully German. He grew up there and everything, and then signed the contract with the Mets. Next is Toby Stoner, who was born at Landstuhl, which is a regional medical center. Which has a regional medical center for the U.S. military. And then obviously he came back to the U.S. with his parents and grew up here. And finally, we have Aaron Elter, who also was born at the same place and similarly came back to the U.S. and grew up here. But they're all technically German-American, Stoner and Elter. Not sure if Gronauer has an American citizenship or not, since he is an actual German national.
So we're training Altair, right?
I mean, Kai Gronauer
really is the best one of all of them, technically.
Well, here, without looking, when was Aaron Altair's weighted runs created plus last season? Without looking.
30?
31?
Try again.
Steve! Price is Right rules in
you. You're not even close. Try again.
18.
You're still not even close.
Negative 20.
Negative 23.
Wow.
He batted 082, 136, 164. 4.5 walk rate, 37.9 strikeout rate.
In his defense, though, he is the only one of these three guys that actually had a major league career of any substance, yeah.
He posted one WAR in 66 plate appearances.
Oddly enough, Toby Stoner has the highest B WAR out of all three of these guys at 0.1 in 11.
Can we just trade all of them?
I think I'm going to go extend Altair, promote Stoner, and trade Gronauer. Because Altair, but yeah, that's a toss-up.
One of them. I'm gonna fire all three into the sun and eat some sauerkraut with a sausage instead.
Sure,
that is a pretty good one. Oh, see, I could have done something like that. I was trying to keep it baseball based, but we could have gone with German delicacies.
German, yeah, that could have been a good one. I wanted to ask you to do a Halo related one because for those of you who are Halo fans, Reach came out this week. But I figured that would not hit a huge subset of our audience.
The thing is, even though I am a emoji B boomer, I have never actually played Halo before.
What is... you're missing out. Anyway, I have no strong opinions about any of these players.
I feel compelled to trade out there just because he is not a Met, whereas Grauenauer and Stoner at least came up through the system. Mm-hmm. And in that case, then, I guess I'm going to be extending Stoner because he did have X amount of professional innings.
It's real unfortunate he didn't get to 4.2 WAR, honestly.
Or 4.2 anything.
Yep.
Yep. Or 6.9 anything.
4.20 ERA, he would be it'd be pretty nice.
It would be. But unfortunately, we can't have nice things.
This is why we can't have nice things.
Yeah, I guess that's a segue. But not really, because it's not like anything the Mets gave up was good. But we're going to start off the week with a little bit of news. And at this point, it's old news, but it's in our wheelhouse here. So we're going to just go over it a little bit. And last week, the Mets traded a pair of minor leaguers, Blake Taylor and Kennedy Corona, for Jake Marisnik. And coincidentally, we talked a little about Corona last week in our DSL, GCL kind of unheralded guys episode. So I just want to get you guys' opinions of this move, because I'm not a fan of it. Not because I think Blake Taylor is going to be anything particularly special. Not because I think Corona is going to be anything particularly special, but just it's just such a bad process move.
I think that sums it up pretty well. I actually just wrote an article about it today.
Functionally, what's the difference between what Jake Marisnik can provide versus what Kevin Pillar could have provided without giving up the, like, talent?
Exactly. And my whole argument was like, look, Pillar was in arbitration, he was due $10 million.
Mm-hmm.
And overarching labor issues aside, some guys do deserve to be non-tendered. Kevin Pillar should not be making $10 million. He's not that good.
Mm-hmm.
He was going to get like $5 to $7 million probably in AAV. Right, so functionally, and there's an argument that PR is more leverageable than Marisnik, right? Because while Marisnik is a better defender, probably, and could steal some bases, his platoon splits are almost non-existent. And he's actually just as bad against lefties as Conforto and Nimmo. Whereas PR, actually, Pillar, whatever, I don't actually know, has significant platoon splits and is a decent hitter against lefties. That's a leverageable skill. Marisnik doesn't have that.
That skill is worth, say, the $3 to $4 million gap between their respective salaries.
You could absolutely. I don't know that that's necessarily true. Like, you could argue, well, Marisnik's a better defender and he brings an element of speed, but right. But they're essentially going to give you the same net package, which means you've, instead of paying $2 to $4 million extra because Marisnik's going to make $3 million or so, you traded Taylor and Corona. Now, I don't really give a shit about Kennedy Corona, but Blake Taylor was one of the more interesting prospects to me this year. Not in the sense that he's like a top 100 dude or whatever, but in the sense that, look, we converted this guy to relief. Suddenly he's dominating as a multi-inning reliever, a lefty who can get righties out too. So you have someone that's both useful for the new three-batter minimum and someone who fits the mold of the new multi-inning relief archetype that's been popular over the last couple seasons that the Mets haven't really had yet. And you say, you know, we're going to trade him away for basically $3 million. Wait, what the hell?
Yeah, not to mention that they literally just moved him to the pen, didn't they?
Yeah,
they moved the season, because, and he was good.
He was really good.
And, like, he was really good, the experiment, and the early returns are promising. I don't know. It doesn't make any goddamn sense to me.
Look, like, let's be real. We're homer prospect guys. We're going to get it. I know I get over-attached to interesting relief guys. God, Stephen Blinds. excuse me. But, like, I was really interested by Taylor. I think I had him in, like, the low teens on my list, maybe mid-teens. Higher than I should, but he's interesting. And the Mets definitely did need a fourth outfield type. You know what they also need? Bullpen help.
Mm-hmm. And, like, three other things. But, yes, bullpen help.
And like, the dude's a spin rate darling. He was a top prep draft pick for a reason. He's got relief capable stuff. And I know we said the same thing last year when we traded JD Davis, but like, I'm not super comfortable trading with the Astros. I don't think the Mets are smarter than the Astros. They probably looked at Taylor and said, that's some nice spin rate there. We'll take that and watch him be like their replacement for Will Harris this year.
Yeah, who do you think is going to provide more value in the major leagues next season, Taylor or Marisnik?
I mean, Marisnik probably, but yeah. Also we're talking about small potatoes.
Also, like you're straight replacing up value.
Lagares is what you're doing.
Mm-hmm. straight up value isn't the right way to evaluate a reliever.
Yeah, because there's all sorts of leverage things. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know. I see Jake Marisnik's going to play a lot, I'm pretty sure. And he really shouldn't.
The Mets always misuse that profile. I'm not even talking about that issue because that's true with whatever fourth outfielder they acquire. Yeah, they're going to misuse him. Right?
Very true.
Like, Marisnik's a guy you should never want to be hitting. Mm-hmm.
And before people start saying, well, yeah, you guys said the JD Davis trade was bad too, and you were wrong. And, like, to be fair, we were. The Mets were right. He had untapped potential. They got they removed the loops from his swing. Brother, I have removed the loops. And suddenly he was hitting bombs. It's like, okay, we were wrong. That's fair. Jake Marisnik is not an unheralded or a former top prospect with 200 plate appearances. He has 5 full seasons in the majors.
Yeah. This isn't like a lottery pick. We know what he is.
It's not the same thing.
Like, he has a lengthy big league track record. That's a few thousand plate appearances long now. Let me look that up and confirm.
And not particularly
good. Yes, almost 2,000
plate appearances. 18,800.
That 18,000 would be a lot of plate appearances.
He has a career 29.8% strikeout rate.
Yeah. Like, listen, Jake Marisnik fits this team well. He's a nice little player. Good fourth outfielder. That's not our problem with this. The problem is that you can get this on the free agent market for only a little bit more and hold on to your interesting relief guy and your old DSL guy who, despite the fact that he's probably not good and has like a funky batting stance or whatever the hell else, raked. Like, that's not worth much, but it's worth something.
It's the bigger problem, I think, is just that it gives us a window into how the Mets operate, and that's the scary part. It's not the players. It's not the player acquired. It's not the players that were sent away. It's just seeing how they do things.
You know the other thing?
Yeah, there's like a short-term thinking here that annoys me every time that they do
it. I mean, talk about short-term. This is his last year of arbitration eligibility. And next year, it's like, we don't have a fourth outfielder again. Guess we better trade that relief depth we have. And then in 4 years, you're like, oh, wait, that's where all our relief depth went. Mm-hmm. Because we just didn't spend like this. This is like and not that I'm saying this trade was bad. This was like trading John Gant and whoever else they traded for Kelly Johnson and Juan Uribe, which at the time was fine because they didn't think they'd contend that year and they didn't flesh out the bench, whatever. But when you are going into a season as a contender, you should just spend the money to get that piece at the start and not throw away relievers.
Yeah, it's a thing that the Mets have done the last couple of years. They're just too willing to give up pieces to acquire players. Sometimes it's worked out, sometimes it hasn't, but just unnecessarily. Mm-hmm. This kind of profile of a player, you can find them on the scrap heap free agent market. Yep. As we're going to talk about in a little bit, there are players that fit this profile that are eligible to be drafted in the Rule 5 draft.
Yeah,
There are ways to get fourth outfielders that don't require giving up assets.
Like, here's the thing, right? In year zero, you trade two mid-tier prospects, or in year zero, you trade two mid-tier prospects for a hole on your roster. You do the same thing every year. These mid-tier prospects that, through random chance, would eventually fill a couple of these marginal roster holes, you're just perpetuating the same problem, right? Because in an ideal system, you're going to develop a fourth outfielder internally. Or you're going to develop middle relievers internally. And the Mets, A, are bad at developing them in the first place, and B, keep trading away these guys because they won't just spend $2 or $3 million to bring them in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like I normally don't have a problem with trading prospects, but like for bench players that you can get elsewhere, mm-hmm. like not great, Bob.
I don't have a problem with it mid-season. If you try
the fact is they're planning now for the season.
Right.
Like, that's like, the look, type of thing you should do to fill a hole, not with the knowledge that you're going into the season with a hole, you know? Right.
Like, look, if you sign John Mayberry Jr. in the offseason to fill a bench role and he just doesn't hit, then you trade a mid-tier prospect to get someone else who is hitting.
To get an upgrade, yep.
Right, it's like, fine.
This is a plan B or a plan C move.
Right.
And instead, it's their plan A.
Because they won't just pony up the money. Now, I will say, maybe like, we're totally misreading Pilar's market or something, but I seriously doubt it.
I mean, is he functionally that different from, like, Buddy Reed? Who's another guy of this profile they could get? Like, Buddy Reed probably can't hit, but the bar isn't high here.
No. I mean, is he that different from Juan Lagares at this point?
No, who will probably be brought in somewhere on an NRI.
Yes.
How bad
the only big difference that I've heard regarding like Kevin Pillar and now Maris Nick is that Pillar is going to get a contract somewhere and he's going to be playing more or less full time. That his numbers and defense and everything, the total package justify that. I don't really know, but that's really the only defense of this that I've heard.
I could see an argument that Pilar will have offers from bad teams that will play him full time. Go get a different fourth outfielder.
Is he that different from Jared Dyson on a 1-year, $2 million deal or something?
Nope. I think Dyson was actually pretty good last year, wasn't
he's
he?
He's had like 3 WAR years recently. Like,
yeah. Like Dyson is better than people realize, I think. No, he was bad last year.
He was bad last year, but he's still an excellent defender, and he's roughly as bad as Jake Marisnyk batting. He's in that class of guys who have one elite skill and not all that much more.
He's a better runner than Marisnyk. He does bat lefty, which is like annoying, but whatever, dude.
And it's not like Marisnyk is a
He hits lefty.
It
was only 46 plate appearances, but he did hit lefties relatively well last year.
This is an extremely fungible profile. Like,
no, yeah, semi-useful player. Like, and more or less the same thing.
It's just, in the grand scheme of things, Corona probably will never see the majors. Mm-hmm. Blake Taylor probably isn't actually good. Right? Like, and this trade means nothing in the end. That's the most likely outcome. But you are trading away that little bit of probability density that Blake Taylor is actually a good reliever in a system where you lack enough guys who have the potential to be good relievers.
In an organization where you traded another of these flyers literally last year for the, you know, useless corpse of Wilmer Font.
Well, that's the other thing, right? We're saying Corona is nothing, and now Catalina might be...
might be something, who knows, but might be something.
What did they trade for Broxton last year? Adam Hill, who we were mildly fond of?
Hill and Felix Valerio.
Was Adam Hill the one from South Carolina?
Yeah, Cortez, maybe.
His teammate?
Yeah, he might have been.
He's on the Mariners now?
Yes, what? he just got traded.
For what?
Other minor league dudes.
Okay. But he wasn't particularly good last year, but whatever.
He was okay.
There was one other guy, and there was also the reliever that hurt himself.
Bobby Wall, who had TOS, and like, I don't care.
And then an elbow, or a knee thing.
Yep. Oh, they traded him as part of the... That's all they had to give up to get Omar Narváez? That's it? The Mets could use Omar Narváez. The Brewers got Omar Narváez for Adam Hill, who the Mets traded to them for Keon Broxton and then was bad in single A for a year, and a 2020 competitive balance pick.
Well, like, the Mets don't make good trades. Usually.
Am I just very wrong about how good Omar Navarez is? He was a really good hitting catcher last year, but it looks like his defense was bad. Omar Navarez, hold on one sec.
He's a left-handed hitter. That would
have been nice.
Be nice to have with Ramos. Would basically give us all of Ramos's ability from against both pitcher types, and you know, not a terribly big step down, okay, given.
Omar Navarez was one of the worst defensive catchers in baseball last year.
But so was
Wilson Ramos, and Omar Navarez costs no money. So you could have traded, instead of trading that piece for Keon Broxton last year, who is the same thing, you could have gotten left-handed Wilson Ramos and not spent $10 million.
Yes, and I'm now looking up platoon splits for both of them. And my guess is they're going to be, Wilson Ramos, 346 average, 423 OBP, 523 slugging. That's 151 WRC plus against lefties. Omar Navarez versus right-handed pitching, 289, 346, 490. That's 123% or 123 weighted. That's a very good offensive platoon.
Your catcher defense is crap, but your catcher offense is incredible. And fuck it, you have a 26th roster spot. Carry Thomas Nito as your defensive third catcher. But this is the thing, though, right? Like, the opportunity cost of doing these really stupid marginal moves instead of just spending $2 million comes back to bite you eventually.
Yep, it all adds up.
It's little things, little bits. And the Mets just don't have the... I think it's just like we always hear these stories about how their plan changes on like a week-to-week basis, whether that's due to incompetent management or the fickleness of ownership or both.
Ron Howard voiceover. It was incompetent management.
Oh, no, I'm saying like incompetent GM or just bad owner or both.
Probably both. Ron Howard.
Probably both. Like, I would trust Sandy a little bit more, but both. Because they don't have an overarching plan for this kind of stuff, they just keep throwing away useful little bits of value. And every time you lose a little bit of value, it adds up.
Yep.
I gave it a C- because, like, it's not as big a deal as, like, it's not like they traded Jimenez for a center fielder or something.
Yeah, like, it's like process F, but impact, like, that, I don't know.
That's fair, I think. A C-, it's fair.
Yep.
All right, well, let's take a break here. And when we get back, we will we'll go over the Rule 5 draft, and maybe the Mets will be able to recoup some of the value that they lost in this trade with one of these guys. So we will be right back after this.
This episode is sponsored by Stash, a smarter, simpler way to start investing. With Stash, you can begin investing in a wide array of companies and diversified funds for as little as $5. Stash offers unlimited trading with no add-on trading commissions, so you can invest without worrying about getting nickel and dimed. You can choose your own stocks and funds to build a personalized portfolio, or let Stash help build one for you. Stash demystifies investing with personalized financial guidance and education, and can even help you set up a plan for retirement saving. Stash will give you $10 today to get started investing. Just visit www.stash.app with the code SBNation. That's www.stash.app with code SBNation to get your $10 to start investing on Stash. Investment advisory services offered by Stash Investments LLC, an SEC registered investment advisor. For disclosures and to learn how to claim your $10 to invest, visit www.stash.app.
Hey, I'm Jason Del Rey. I recently wrapped up Land of the Giants, The Rise of Amazon. In this podcast, we examine how Jeff Bezos turned a small online bookseller into one of the most powerful companies in the world. We start by exploring how Amazon Prime became a service with over 100 million members and the main source of the company's power.
I mean, I think that's kind of what Amazon's banking on, right? That you're just so locked in that you're going to go to any other sites because, I mean, I don't.
And we end the season by pondering the question, is Amazon too big?
you know, and we just don't want to be the United States of Amazon. We just really don't.
Land of the Giants has been recommended by the New York Times, Axios, Wired, and more. It's a candid look at the state of Amazon today, how we got here, and what the future might look like. The entire first season is out now. Find out more and binge it on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app.
Welcome back, everybody. I am Steve Saipa. I'm joined by Lucas Vlahos and Ken Lavin, and this is From Complex to Queens. And this week, the winter meetings are going to be starting, and that means that the Rule 5 draft is going to be taking place at the end. And for anybody unfamiliar with it, basically it was created as a way to stop teams from hoarding and stashing their minor league talent in their farm system. So players that meet certain criteria, basically when they are signed and how many years of experience they have under their belt, they have to be added to the 40-man roster and protected, or anyone else can select them for a nominal fee of just $100,000. And if the player makes it the entire season with their new team, they officially become members of that team and everything's good. If they don't, then they have to be offered back to the original team, although the original team doesn't actually have to take them back. That's kind of cruel and sad, but that's baseball life, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And in the past, there have been some pretty amazing successes. Roberto Clemente is the, you know, original Rule 5 draft success. There have been a couple of all-stars.
Johan Santana.
Santana, Josh Hamilton, Dan Uggla. They were all
Rule
5 pickups.
Josh Hamilton was a Rule 5 pick? I didn't know that, actually.
Uh-huh. Yep. There have been plenty of, like, non-all-star acquisitions that went under the radar and worked out decently enough for the teams. But obviously, for every success, there's hundreds of failures. You know, guys that just didn't cut it because they just weren't good enough to roster to
Brad
be rostered for an entire year. Yeah.
Who was that lefty they got from the Braves? Sean Washington.
Yes.
He was okay for a couple of years.
Yeah, that definitely was a under-the-radar move that worked out. He made the roster for the entire team that year for the Mets.
We had him for a couple of years.
Yeah, he was good for, I think, the first year and then not that great in the second. And then that was kind of it. But 1 year, you know, of success is good enough to, I would say, to count as a Rule 5 draft success. So anyway, there's always tons of guys available in the major league part. It would take a long time to literally list every single worthwhile guy, every single interesting, semi-interesting guy that could, you know, theoretically play some kind of role for the team. So instead of just kind of listing things and just droning on about a bunch of guys, the three of us, we picked a couple of the guys that we like, and we'll just kind of go over them, why we think that they make sense. Does anybody want to start?
I'm okay going first. I got way too deep into this doing my AAOP, so I have a couple guys I care about deeply now for no real reason.
That is one of the worst parts of, like, doing draft stuff and prospect stuff, is you'll just pick these random guys and you just latch onto and...
Uh-huh. Yep, it's terrible.
All right, so who is your first Rule 5 pick?
My first Rule 5 pick is Brett Cumberland. So Brett Cumberland was one of the few real prospects I saw when I was at Cal. He was the starting catcher. He was a Golden Spike finalist the year I saw him. Switch-handed catcher, lots of power, really nice approach at the plate, took his walks, worked pitchers. But that was, of course, in college. And then I wanted the Mets to take him, but the Braves took him in the second round of 2016. And he started hitting. He didn't hit in his draft year, but I don't really care. And then the next year he came back and just started mashing. The problem, of course, with him was always that his defense was highly suspect, and it's still pretty suspect. He probably needs to move. He might need to move off the position. In 2018, they traded him to the Orioles, I believe, as part of the Darren O'Day trade. I think it was that, or maybe it was the Kevin... No, it was the Kevin Gausman trade, I think. Or were they together? Point is, he wound up on the Orioles, still hitting. He missed most of 2019 with injury, only got 200 plate appearances, but again, still mashing in 157 plate appearances at AA. He hit 248, 395, 408. That's a 144 weighted in whatever league and park that is. So, according to some scouting reports at the start of 2018, the defense had improved, not to the point where it was good, but to the point where it might be playable, right? The Mets have almost no upper minors catching depth. It's Wilson Ramos, whose health is like held together by some scotch tape and glue. Thomas Nito, who can't hit. And Ollie Sanchez, who also probably can hit and has, what, like 200 plate appearances in the high minors or less? So Cumberland as like a I don't want to say top prospect. I don't think he was ever a top 100 prospect. But as a catcher who can hit from both sides of the plate, can work a pitcher well, can work an at bat, has power. It's an organizational weakness. There's no cost to just grabbing him out of the Orioles system and seeing if he can stick as a backup in the short term and maybe become a long-term piece if and when he sticks around and Ramos leaves.
It's a solid profile, and if he can hit a lick,
I think he'll hit in the majors. It's just a matter of is the defense Wilson Ramos bad, or is it like even just worse. Average bad?
Yeah.
Right?
Catching defense is, I don't know, not overrated, but it a little bit is overrated to me.
Mm-hmm. I just liked him because it's such an organizational weakness and because he's someone I've had my eye on for a while.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And the Orioles left him unprotected. Now, it's probably not a good sign that a team as bad as the Orioles is leaving you unprotected, but
I'm going to go ahead and say that we shouldn't even weigh that, given that they just released their, or non-tendered, their literal best player.
also a fair point.
Who even knows what they're doing at this point?
I don't think even they know what they're doing.
All right, Ken, who do you got?
I'm going to start with Cody Sedlock, also from the Orioles. He was a pitcher drafted in 2016. He was a college reliever until he was converted to a full-time starter in his junior year. He was one of those guys who was mostly a college reliever, but had a really good starting season in their draft year. And he's basically been nothing but hurt since. He had a strained flexor mass in his elbow that forced him to miss time in 2017, and then in 2018, he missed a lot of time with what Wikipedia is describing to me as effects of thoracic outlet syndrome, although apparently he did not need surgery for it.
Hmm. That's still concerning.
Still very concerning, but yeah. My logic here is that he's only been a starter, really, sort of in the Zapucki mold, where he's kind of semi-stretched out, but never really. And his only real starting experience was, you know, as a junior in the Big Ten. So I'm going to go ahead and say that, you know, he's probably in the same general class, if healthy, as the up and down guys we are currently using. Mm-hmm. And who knows, the stuff might play up a little bit, finally going back to what he's arguably should have been from the beginning, which is a reliever. So you're getting a guy who, you know, we have a few of, but none with any form of upside. Cody Sedlock. And if he gets hurt, you put him on the DL and you get the player for free anyway.
Yeah, that's
so. That's
another good point, actually.
That is a strategy. That is a legit strategy.
Yep.
So I wonder. I meant to ask this at the top of the segment. I wonder if it's easier to hide a position player now than a pitcher because of the extra roster spot and because the number of pitchers you have is capped. I don't know.
You could see a lot more kind of catchers, because you always have, you know, your main catcher and your backup catcher, and teams are always reluctant to use that backup catcher in any way, shape, or form, just in case, you know, game goes extra innings, you need to swap him out. If you're able to now roster another catcher or another kind of guy that is capable of playing catcher, you could start seeing those backup catchers being used in more situations. So you could see a guy like you selected, Lucas, where, you know, he's more valuable now because of that extra roster spot and that ability to play catcher. Mm-hmm.
But I feel like historically it's been like, hey, we can sacrifice a bench player and then just have a pitcher we never pitch. And then over time it's turned into, okay, now we need eight people in our bullpen and we can't hide anyone anymore. And now they've added an extra roster spot, but it can't be used on a pitcher. I don't know. I'm very intrigued to see what the dynamics are. But like Ken said, take a pitcher who's going to get hurt and just put him on the DL. Problem solved.
So there's a little bit of upside and also functionally no downside.
Yep.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing with most of these players is that there is no real downside to you roll the dice, and if it doesn't work out, you know, oh well.
And what if it does work out, then yeah, great. What's the cost for the Rule 5 pick? It's like $50,000 or...
$100,000.
I think it's $100,000 to take, and then you return $50,000 if... Yep. They can buy him back for $50,000 if he's not.
So, in terms of a functional baseball organization, literally nothing.
Although the Mets have a track record of, you know, taking these guys to sell them back.
Yes. Or trade them for money.
Yeah.
Not good.
Yep.
Though, honestly, trading them for, like, if there's not someone that fits your roster and you trade the pick for money, I don't hate it, but, like, whatever.
That's one of those things that it's not even being used for anything functional to the team, so you're just making the owners richer, and screw that.
That's true as well.
If it's something for, like, I don't know if you can, but if you're trading, if you can trade the Rule 5 player then for, like, international slot bonus money or cap space, something like that, then okay, I'm fine with, you know, at least it's serving some kind
A competitive
baseball purpose.
Yeah, I guess the money you're getting for any of these Rule 5 picks isn't enough to actually... Like, hey, you can only sign this reliever if you sell our Rule 5 pick for $200,000. I don't think anyone is having that conversation.
No. I would hope not. I mean, Will Pons, they might be.
God, just 5 more years. And then it gets worse.
Mm-hmm. Probably. All right. So the first dude that I looked at here is Sterling Sharp. He's a right-handed pitcher in the National system. He missed most of the season this year. He hurt his oblique in May. But he posted a 3.99 ERA in 49.2 innings with AA Harrisburg prior to that point. And, you know, the numbers, the peripherals were pretty good. 56 hits, 14 walks, 45 strikeouts. And then he made a couple of starts in the AFL. And the numbers were fair, but the reports were kind of so-so. And his stuff is kind of so-so to begin with, so that's a little worrisome. The biggest thing about him is that even on his best days, when he's fully healthy and everything, the fastball velocity is kind of fringy, tops out in like the low 90s. And reports in the AFL, he was more high 80s to 90, so that's less good. But the pitch has like a ton of sink to it. And for his entire career, he's posted elite ground ball rates, like 60% plus or so at every stop in the minors, practically. So
it was like 75 at a couple. Oh, that's only in 7 innings. Okay.
Small amounts. Yeah. But
that's still nuts.
Yeah. I mean, when you're getting that many sink ground balls, like fastball velocity is kind of like whatever. And you know, the fastball isn't completely a crap pitch. He's pretty tall. So he gets some extension on it, and he's played around with his timing with like hiccups and pauses in his delivery to mess around with the batter's timing. So it plays up a little bit more than just pure velocity. And then he complements it with a changeup. That's his best secondary, and a slider. And he does everything, you know, everything that you want to see in a good changeup. He does. It has good velocity differential. He doesn't slow his arm down. It has solid fade and tumble. Slider, it's kind of more sweepy. Not really like a strikeout pitch right now, but it's just another weapon in the arsenal to keep guys honest and, you know, get some poor contact. It's not overall like a super sexy package, but he's a real heavy sinker ball guy in a fly ball era. He has good command. He doesn't issue too many walks. he might be a late bloomer, and those secondary pitches might get better, so you never know. And he'd basically be like the instant fifth starter. And just the overall package, I think I have more faith in him to be a fifth starter than like Walker Lockett, you know?
Are you telling me that Walker Lockett is bad?
Yeah, I might be saying that.
Shock, big if true.
Yeah, and it's one of those things because he's a Rule 5 draft guy. Like, you know, he's bad in 3 or 4 starts, then you just cut ties, and that's the end of it, and you don't need to worry.
Can we just call him Walter Lockett on this podcast from now on?
It's so, I always want to say Walter.
It's just weird to me because the first time I looked at it, I saw Walker Lockett. And I was like, okay, Walker Lockett. And everybody starts saying Walter Lockett. And I just didn't get why.
Because people are dumb,
like,
Steve.
And it's just like, did I miss something? I don't know what's happening.
You did not. It's just a silly name.
It is. It is a silly name. Is it even his real name? Or is it just like one of those nicknames that kind of has actually become like his actual name?
I don't actually know. That's a good question.
Wikipedia, his name is Andrew Walker Lockett.
See? There you go.
It's his middle name. Although, to be fair, if I had the... I would maybe go by Drew, but if I had Drew the choice Lockett. To go between Andrew and Walker, I might choose to go with Walker.
Oh, it's just not good.
Yeah.
All right. Lucas, who do you have? Do you have someone that maybe uses their actual name?
I have someone with one of the more weird names in baseball, I think. But
great segue.
I don't even know how to pronounce it, honestly. LJ Lay. It's spelled literally LJAY Newsome. I'm just going to go with LJ for the purposes of this. So Newsom was a pick in the 2015 draft by the Mariners, and he's always been a guy with exceptional control. Like, the highest walk rate he ever posted was 2.23 per nine, and at every other level it's been below 2. Most levels it's actually been below 1. So the dude's just a finesse artist, and I think it's absolutely possible that he's the kind of pitcher, like we've talked about what Miguel Montero's problems were, where he just pounds the strike zone and his stuff is good enough in the minors, and then he gets to the majors and guys just tee off and he starts nibbling and blah, blah, blah. So I think that's certainly possible. But the stats in the minor leagues have been encouraging. His strikeouts ticked up in 2019. His fastball gained a couple miles per hour. The walk stayed low. He limited homers pretty well. He's definitely a fly ball pitcher, which also lends to the risk that he's just going to get teed off on, especially with the major league ball. And he only made one start in AAA. But similar to your argument about Sharp, I'm not sure that he's. Let me put it. I'd be more willing to bet on him as a fifth starter or long man out of the pen than Walker Lockett.
So basically the bar is, are you better than Walker Lockett?
I mean, yeah, on the Mets roster, it's absolutely, are you better than Walker Lockett and Steven Gonsalves or Gonsalves, whatever.
I think Massa is still around.
Oh, right, because Chris Flexen just went to Korea and Mazza's still here.
I just want to say, good for you, Chris Flexen.
Yeah, absolutely.
You do you, bud. RIP, sexy Flexi.
God. I don't have strong feelings about him. I haven't watched any videos of him. The minor league stats are cool. The extreme command profile is cool. There was a tangible improvement in the fastball last year. Bring him into camp, give him a shot, see if he sticks.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what kind of influence over all the pitchers, obviously, but anyone who's brought in, you know, with kind of flaws, like a Rule 5 guy, is the new pitching coach, Jeremy Hefner, will have. Well,
I'm extremely interested to see Hefner's effect, because supposedly he's always been very bright in terms of bringing the analytical side of things into the game. And I think having a younger former player making those communications will translate better. And you could have found several articles going into this offseason talking him up as one of the better coaching candidates out there. So I'm really interested to see what he does.
Yeah, hopefully it's a pretty tangible impact that he has. All right, Ken, who is your next guy?
I'm going to go with pretty much the exact opposite and go with Jordan Sheffield, pitcher from the Los Angeles Dodgers. This is another sort of homer pick. Early in 2016, he was one of the early guys the Mets were linked to, as they inevitably always are for seemingly polished college pitchers that might move quickly. But
they're already linked to that for the upcoming draft. Sorry.
Oh, yeah. No, it's the early returns always. But he was recently he was drafted as a starter out of Vanderbilt. And, started for a few years, but really couldn't stay healthy. His command, his mechanics are very relievery. And then he was converted to a reliever last year by the Dodgers, and things went a lot better. He wasn't like elite by any means between advanced A and double A, but he struck a lot of dudes out. And it was 13.5 K per nine in advanced A, and then 11.47 K per nine for the double A team. Although his command, his command is super scattershot, and that's ultimately what's probably gonna, limit his ceiling a little bit. But he's got a fastball that is thought to be, 95 to 97, touching 98, consistently out of the pen. Gets a lot of swings and misses off of it, and a high spin slider that also took a major step forward last year. So as a two pitch reliever, again, a spot that they could use. And the downside here is you have Jacob Rame 2.0, or, and the upside is you get a potentially useful middle reliever.
I mean, given
that walk
the fact
rate
is real bad. Yes. But I've always kind of liked the stuff a little bit, and, another year in the pen, maybe it stabilizes a little bit.
And that's another thing that Jeremy Hefner's influence, he's a younger guy, like Lucas was saying, maybe he'll be able to, how much older is Hefner than Sheffield? Like maybe
Hefner's
15,
like
10?
He's like 33.
33.
Yeah, so 9 years.
Yeah, so okay, so he's not even a decade older.
Hefner could still be playing.
Yeah.
He could still be playing.
I didn't realize he was that young. Jeez.
So maybe Hefner will be able to, reach these kids, that kind of thing, So my next guy here is going to be Michael Geddes. And he was drafted in the second round of the 2014 draft. And at the time, it felt like he was going to be a big deal, and he just hasn't been able to develop the necessary baseball skills to turn all those tools that he has into a big league player. He spent all of last year with the El Paso Chihuahuas, that is the Padres' AAA affiliate, and he hit 256, 305, 517 in 128 games. Slugging percentage looks great, but taken into account that's the PCL, so even though he was slugging over 500, it is actually a WRC plus of 88, which is slightly below average. So that just goes to show how crazy the PCL is. But, since day one when he was drafted, the swing is very concerning, and nothing has really changed. And his pitch recognition skills were kind of poor. Bad swing mechanics, they all, they both have held him back, his entire career. But for years, it's felt like he's just kind of like a tweak or two away from being a monster at the plate. And with his physicality and his bat speed and everything, maybe this is the year that he breaks out. But, nothing has changed, and that's been the case for years, so who knows. But as an everyday player, I think he would kind of sink fast, kind of like Keon Broxton last year. But if you're using sparingly as a backup, I think there's a lot of qualities that could be useful. Defensively, he's kind of rangy, has a real strong arm. Not the best fielder out there, but he's played a capable center field for a majority of his career. So, nothing wrong with that. on the base paths, he's speedy, could be like a 20 stolen base guy if he got enough opportunities. And if you use him as like a pinch runner situations, you know, he could possibly accumulate that many opportunities. The raw powers plus, you know, just the hit tools plus, is poor. So maybe every once in a while he runs into a homer or two. And it would be interesting to see if Chili Davis helps him, because Chili Davis's philosophy is pretty much the exact kind of opposite of what you would think a guy who has plenty of power would be doing. And that kind of does seem like one of the flaws in Geddes' game. It's just kind of, you know, his situational hitting and making contact and that kind of stuff. And that is the stuff that Chili Davis supposedly excels at. So maybe his presence is the thing that helps Geddes turn that corner. But who knows?
It's good. I mean, we had a similar conversation when Dan Worthen was the coach about grabbing players to fit your coaching staff, right? Like, if you have Dan Worthen, you should get guys with polish but lacking an out pitch and teach them the Worthen slider. Maybe if you have Chili Davis on staff, you need to grab people with power but who can't hit and get Chili Davis to teach them how to make contact. That said, I don't know that actually works.
Yeah, I don't know either, but he's a guy that I've always liked, but mm-hmm. You know.
I mean, look, they have the Mets. The Mets need it. They have a spot on the bench, right? Like, it's gonna be. Let's assume that McNeil and Davis are starting. You have Lowry on the bench. You have a backup catcher. You have Marisnik. You have Guillorme, and there's still one spot there. So I mean, they need something.
It's better than just a light hitting shortstop.
Mike Moroff, who they're apparently very high on.
Yes, not good.
Be high on Mike Moroff. I don't understand. I don't understand.
They don't understand either. That's the problem, I think.
It's not great.
No. All right, let's take another break here. And when we get back, we'll go over three more guys that we each like. So we will be right back after this.
Hey, I'm Spencer Hall.
I'm Holly Anderson.
I'm Ryan Nanny.
I'm Jason Kirk. And we're the hosts of the Shutdown Fullcast, your Avengers of College Football podcast. It says here in the script I'm to riff on what that means. And basically what I mean is it's all already spoiled.
Every Tuesday, we talk about everything from cooking disasters to pro wrestling to unfashionable pants we wore in middle school.
We also do talk about college football every now and then, like mascot fights, announcers fleeing the booth early, and unfashionable pants that coaches wear now.
If you want to take college football exactly as seriously as it should be taken, subscribe for free on Apple Podcasts or in your favorite podcast app.
All right, welcome back to From Complex to Queens. I'm Steve Seipel, and I'm joined by Lucas Vlahos and Ken Levin. And we're just going over, we'll go over our final Rule 5 draft hopefuls here. So, Lucas, who do you got?
So, the last guy I was looking at is Eli White. So, he is a super utility guy for the Rangers. He was actually part of the Jerickson Profar trade last offseason when the A's got him from the Rangers in the first place. So White's 25 years old, limited upside, and had a down year offensively last year. So he was running a weighted runs created in the 130s in AA and then slipped all the way down to 84 in AAA last year. That said, he still hit 14 homers. He stole 14 bases. He walked a decent amount. The strikeouts were way up. And there was a definite BABIP progression, but there's some intrigue to him as a guy who's, not gonna hit for a ton of average, but has some pop, has some speed, and has seen time at second, third, short, and center field, and looked competent at all of those spots over the last two seasons. In many ways, he's kind of fits the same role that Marisnik does, but with more flexibility and cheaper, right? So Marisnik is obviously the better player. Better on defense, probably a better hitter. Not even probably, is a better hitter. But White has a nice blend of filling several different spots on the diamond competently, which is useful with that last roster spot, providing some speed, which is something the roster's lacking. So in terms of gambles to take on the last spot on the bench, I think White's pretty interesting. And the Rangers left him unprotected.
Yeah, the versatility is an interesting aspect, especially when you take into account that the Mets have a lot of guys that they're not necessarily playing out of position, but they're playing them in positions where defensively they're not particularly great at. Mm-hmm. So it gives more, gives the team more of a chance to kind of swap guys in, swap guys around, at all different positions.
Like, look, he's not going to be as good defensively as Guillorme, obviously, but if he's an average defender and can hit better with than Louis Guillorme, which is a pretty low bar, it's a useful piece to have on the bench.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like a guy needs to start 9 innings. If you're swapping him in for a pinch hit appearance and then, you know, an inning, like, it's probably not going to cause a terrible chain reaction.
Yeah, and it'd be nice... this is something else I've been wondering about with the extra roster spot. If the return, if pinch running becomes more popular again, because you have a 5-man bench, and the Mets don't really have anyone to do that right now. They have Mariznick, I guess, but having two guys who could steal on the bench would be an advantage, hopefully.
Yeah.
Lord knows you're not putting Tomas Nido on base to steal.
No, probably not. All right, Ken, who is your final pick?
A player of a similar mold in Buddy Reed, outfielder from the San Diego Padres organization. The report on Reed is pretty simple. He is as athletic a player as you'll ever see. Extremely fast, very good defender, but has never really hit all that well. So he was drafted in 2016, was a college teammate of Pete Alonso's, which is more or less the entire reason why I chose him. like I said, struggled to hit up until advanced A, and then struggled in his first taste in double A, and then repeated double A this last year, and was like a roughly league average hitter. But ultimately, it comes down to, I don't think he's that different from Jake Mariznick or Keon Broxton or Kevin Pillar, in that he's a guy who has a pretty easily leverageable skill set for a bench role. So that's, as a speed and defense bench player that you're hoping to get as much value out of that and limit his exposure offensively as much as possible.
Yet another reason why trading for Mariznick so early in the offseason was just a puzzling move.
These guys are everywhere.
Yep.
We've been talking for what, an hour, and we've mentioned like 6 of them who are more or less interchangeable.
All right. My final guy is going to be, if Michael Geddes was a big Hail Mary, then the guy that I'm about to pick here is an even bigger one in terms of him riding the ship, and that is Alec Hansen. He's another guy that was drafted in the second round of his draft, in 2016, and it feels like he's been around forever and just hasn't been able to put everything together. He pitched last season with high A Winston-Salem and double A Burlington, which are the White Sox's affiliates. And he posted a combined 4.64 ERA in 52.1 innings in his first year as a dedicated reliever. And he walked, he struck out 44, and he walked 44, and he struck out 66. And the numbers are crappy, and he has a little bit of a injury history, but Hansen's not really that far off from being considered one of the better prospects in baseball. Going into the 2018 season, so 2 years ago now, Baseball America ranked him 57, MLB Prospect Pipeline ranked him 54, Baseball Prospectus ranked him 40. So there is a lot of upside in there. He hurt his forearm, and he missed the first couple of seasons of the 2018—excuse me, he missed the first couple of months of the 2018 season. And then when he did get back on the field, things kind of spiraled out of control. He wasn't physically 100%, and he started experiencing depression and anxiety. And, you know, it is something is massively wrong when the guy that can throw like 97 was throwing like 87 in like the second inning. But his control, it was never that great. Even when he was at his best, just kind of completely evaporated. He'd be like walking like 5, 6, 7, 9 guys in a couple of innings of work. He was a little better this past year out of the bullpen, but it was still pretty unpredictable. There'd be stretches where he walked like, you know, 2, 3 guys in a couple of appearances, which is not great, but it's not too bad either. And then there would be games where he'd walk like 3, 4 guys. So still don't really know what you're going to be getting. But if you just ignore the numbers and you just look at the tools, there's a lot to like. When he's on, he's got 4 pitches that grade out as fringe average to above average. Fastball sits 90 to 95. It can top out at like 97. Get some plane because he's a tall guy, has a little bit of cutting movement. Curveball, he could throw, you know, a sharp 12-6-1 or an 11-5-1 with 2 plane movement. And he could throw off his strikes. He could bury outside the zone, wherever he wants to put it.
Sounds like change he's putting up. It outside the zone too often.
Yeah, a little too often. Change up, it has some good fade and tumble. He throws out of the same slot as the fastball. That gets about 10 miles per hour of velocity separation. Slider was never his best pitch, but it was, you know, good enough to be incorporated into his arsenal and you know, set up his other stuff because it's in the mind of hitters. But when he was not on, you know, he could be pretty bad. And, you know, is he a guy like Michael Geddes? Is he a guy that maybe the Mets will have a better chance at fixing than a couple of other teams have had? Because, you know, White Sox have not been able to unlock the potential in there.
I do wonder about how much success did the White Sox have with fixing like Michael Kopech, for instance, right? Because he had that same horrible level of control problem as well. Of course, he's hurt now, but I don't know that the White Sox are exactly the best developmental organization. So I could absolutely buy that maybe on a different team he does better. But he might also need so much time to improve that you can't hide him.
Yeah, I mean, he's a guy. And then if you are hiding him and pitching him, say, once a week, whatever the case may be, like, yeah, you're not really helping your own situation. But it's definitely a lot of upside if you just kind of ignore all the negatives.
Yeah, I mean, the underlying components for a good pitcher are there. You just got to do a lot of work to get to them.
Yep. All right, well, does anyone have any last words for the week?
Please, no one take Harrell. I'll be sad if someone takes Harrell.
Yeah, there's a couple of guys in the system that theoretically could be taken in the Rule 5 draft.
I can see, like, the Orioles taking Newton.
Yeah, there's Harrell, there's Chevalier Newton, there's Patrick Mazeika. I don't really foresee anyone taking them, but, you know, who knows? Yeah. Obviously, depending on what the Mets do, what other teams do, we'll go over that stuff next week. But if anyone has any questions or comments or whatever, you can send us an email at our email address from complextoqueens@gmail.com. You can follow us on Twitter and shoot questions there. I'm at Steve Saipa. Lucas is at El Vlahos 343. And Ken is at KenLavin91. If you don't already subscribe to the podcast, subscribe to our podcast. You'll get our show and all of the Amazing Avenue productions. Rate and review. And, of course, thank you for listening. And like I said, we'll be back next week with a recap of the Rule 5 draft and how the Mets did and how everybody else did. And until then, love the Mets. Love the Mets.
Are you troubled by strange hockey trades in the middle of the night?
Do you experience feelings of dread about NHL free agency?
Have you or your family ever seen a New York Islanders game?
If the answer is yes, then don't wait another minute. Pick up your mobile device and subscribe to Lighthouse Hockey Podcast from SB Nation today.
Our courteous and efficient hosts are ready to serve all of your Islander needs and worries.
Lighthouse Hockey Podcasts for New York Islanders fans.